Welcome, everyone, to TheoCon Thursday's Conversation. And we are glad that we are back again on the third Thursday of the month with TheoCon having a conversation of how pop culture and geek culture intersects with our faith and our lives. And so I am Will Rose. I am on the steering committee for TheoCon, and also pastor at Holy Trinity Lutheran Church and Lutheran Campus Ministry in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And really happy that we have our guests here tonight, some people that I really look up to and how they engage geek culture in their ministries and their lives and how they follow Jesus. And so we're excited about that. A little bit about TheoCon. We have some other videos from our TheoCon Thursday conversations where we've had special guests and talk about different subjects. And so what TheoCon is that we are a conference, a convention, a conversation, relationships, a movement that engages how pop culture can intersect with faith. And so we not only geek out on pop culture things, whether it's comics or sci-fi or fantasy and video games and TV shows and movies. We're not only entertained by this kind of fandom and entertainment, but we are also engaging in how they can help us go deeper with the questions of life and faith and seeing how they intersect with our lives. And so, yeah, we're here to do that tonight. Brian is a part of this steering committee as well. And Brian, anything else to add about TheoCon and what we do and what we're up to?
No, I think we're good.
Yeah, and kind of what we have done, and TheoCon was started by Shayna Watson. She couldn't be here with us this evening, but she started TheoCon. She saw a need and was asked to do some panels, has some questions. You can read about her story and her origin story of TheoCon on the website and also on the Facebook page. There's been a few TheoCon conventions over the last few years, usually happening around September. We had one last September, and we had one planned for this September. And as the world turns with what we are dealt with in terms of a global pandemic, shut that down. But then that forced us, this challenge also forced us with a new opportunity to spread the word about what TheoCon is and what we're doing. And we decided to have these conversations on our YouTube channel on Thursdays leading up to this September, where we hope to do an online webinar, an online symposium, some panels where we can gauge geek culture, pop culture, and theology and faith. So that's what we're doing. So we'll maybe at the end share a little bit more how you can engage with TheoCon and how you can plug in, but we're glad you're here. As I said, I'm glad with our roundtable discussion tonight. We don't have like a main guest, but we're going to do a roundtable discussion on alpha rogues, on villains. We have a lot of conversations around our favorite heroes and our favorite blockbuster movies and those kind of things. But what is it about villains that compel us or make the hero that drive the story or the plot? And a little bit later on, I'll share, I did some Googling today to look up different popular pop culture websites about the top villains, and I was interested what they said, and we'll see if ours match up with some of those. But as I said, you know, when it comes to geek culture, I know all of us, it's our hobby, part of how we escape or entertain ourselves, a way to kind of go to another world, another place, and in the midst of a world that can seem pretty cruel and heavy at times. But not only do these stories entertain us and give us an opportunity to escape, but they also give us a nice opportunity and a sandbox to play with the big questions that we all wrestle with. To have our imaginations engage the other aspects of ourself when it comes to faith and theology and discipleship. And I think all of us here, I'm really proud that none of us engage geek culture in a way that's manipulative or perhaps a Trojan horse that has some kind of coercive, manipulative agenda to it, but that we're just trying to like find our way into this kind of pop or niche culture to find our way to manipulate others. But we really are interested about these stories and how they affect us and the questions that we're asking and wrestle with, our identities around these things. So I'm really, really happy that you all are here. So what I want to do tonight, as we get started here, to go around the horn, and if you would introduce yourself, share where you live, your context for ministry or vocation, what you do, and how you engage geek culture, and then what's your geek of choice, or maybe your first love in geek culture. So there you go. Why don't we go with Hector, if you don't mind going first. I'm gonna go clockwise of how it looks on my Zoom screen, but Hector, why don't you introduce yourself?
So my name is Hector Mirai, and I am the location pastor for Vertical Church Lumberton in Lumberton, North Carolina. Been here for 6 years, and before that I worked as a college pastor at UNC Pembroke, and then before that I ran a Bible camp in Fairmont, North Carolina. So I've been in ministry in a variety of capacities for a couple decades. But my geek intro, or where I'm at with that, is that I write a book series called Faith and Fandom, which is devotionals and Bible studies on video games, pop culture, sci-fi, video games, comic books, all those things. And usually travel to about 20 to 25 Comic-Cons a year to just be present and be a loving influence in those places, build relationships with other vendors and artists and con promoters and stuff like that, and as attendees as well. And that's my main heart and focus with that. So that's my that's me with that. And I'll say not my first love, but probably my most predominant geek love would be Doctor Who. Just really taken over kind of a big influence in my life over the last however many years, and to the point that one of my kids is named after a Doctor Who character. So
is it Dalek?
That's the dog. No, River. It is. I do have a kid named after River Song, and her name is Carmen Song. And I tried to get her to be named River Grace, so I could get River Tam and River Song in the same clump. But my wife didn't want, as she put it, an inanimate noun as her child's first name. So. So Doctor Who is our family's kind of go-to for a lot of things. So that's me.
That's awesome. Cool.
Yeah. And Hector has a podcast, Faith and Fandom podcast as well. One of the features that I like on that is this critical hit where it is like a minute, maybe 30 seconds, where you just throw out a quip and words of wisdom for the real short attention span podcast listener. He's got some for you. He also works with Love Thy Nerd, which also is another website and blog and podcast that engages geek culture with faith as well. So yeah, and Hector and I, we've done some panels together at North Carolina Comic Con, and met him at a North Carolina Comic Con a few years back, where he had a table and he had his book there, and I was like, Faith and Fandom, what's this? Oh, a fellow pastor engages. So it was pretty cool and pretty awesome. So yeah, Hector, glad you're here.
Me too.
JR, why don't you introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is JR Forresters, and I pastor at Catalyst Church, which is part of the Church of the Nazarene. I'm in Dallas, Texas. Been here about 6 years. I'm one of those that is not a native Texan, but I drank the Kool-Aid as soon as I got here and love it. So very, very, very much love Texas. And let's see, I am part of the Fascinating podcast with three other authors. I have a book called Empathy for the Devil, which is all about the villains of the Bible, and how, if we understand them a little bit better, maybe we can not apologize for the things they did, but actually maybe see the seeds of some of their sins in our own spirits. So fun. I had fun with it. I like it. I'm as I say, unreasonably proud of it. But I co-host the Fascinating podcast with three other authors, where we talk about well, as it says, whatever is fascinating us, but a good bit of the time that's pop culture. And then I also write and am a part of the Think Christian podcast team. So I write a lot of pop culture and faith for them. That's kind of my main pop culture and faith outlet. And, you know, probably until a couple of years ago, if you had asked me what my first geek love was, I would have said like sword and sorcery fantasy, because the Shannara books were kind of my gateway drug into big boy books. And, you know, I read the Chronicles of Thomas Covenant on the heels of that. But over the last couple of years, I've recognized that my true first love in geekdom is the weird kid, even by geek standards, and that's horror. I have been obsessed with horror ever since I was like a little kid. Like one of the first movies I ever remember watching was Ghostbusters, which admittedly is horror comedy, but when you're like five, it's still pretty scary. Yeah. You know, I had every single Goosebumps book. I would save my allowance up and go to the bookstore on the day they came out each month to buy them. And still today, horror is easily my first love. I love looking at horror through a critical lens and using it as a diagnostic tool for our culture. It's just my favorite thing. So I know even by geek standards, that's still kind of the weird kid that hangs out by himself in the corner, but that's it. That's my first love. So
yeah, that's cool. I'm proud, because every now and then we showed our girls block Ghostbusters way back when, and still to this day, they're still like, I think Ella the other day went something like, listen, smell something? And I was like, oh, I'm so proud of that deep cut comedy. So good. Yeah, and I also know with Think Christian, they also bring you on board mostly when there's a good comic run that that you'll blog and talk about comics. So I remember that's when you came to my attention. I was like, ah, he's talking about Hickman's run on X-Men. Yes, we connect. So,
yeah, that's actually very self-serving for our editor, Josh Larson. He knows that if he's going to edit what I write, he has to read it himself. And so he's happy to assign me comic stuff. So that means he gets an excuse to read comics. So,
right. That's awesome. Sylvia, why don't you introduce yourself?
I'm Sylvia McCorkle, and I am an Army veteran, and I currently work as a military data analyst, and I live and work in Virginia. I always tell people that I believe that I was Southern Baptist in utero. I grew up across the street from the church, so it was a lot of church inside and outside of the home. Very strict upbringing. So a lot of my exposure to non-church things were through reading, but grew up in a Star Trek-centric household. So when Star Wars came around, I was like, oh my goodness, this is me. And there's a cool girl and she's fighting. It's like, okay, I really like her. My other love is horror also. And you think you're the weird kid outside of the circle when you're the black kid that likes horror. You really, really are the weird kid outside of the circle. I don't read most of the comic books that have, I said, most of my comic book heroes don't wear capes. So I'm a big Neil Gaiman fan.
Yeah, nice.
And as Will can attest to, I am a diehard fan of AMC's The Walking Dead. I do enjoy the graphic novel, but I'm going to be there to the end with that
show. Wow, that's impressive.
It is impressive. And that's how Sylvie and I bonded. Like, we go way back to Williston Junior High in Wilmington, North Carolina. And you went to high school at New Hanover? Did you go to New Hanover? Yeah, New Hanover. I went to EA Laney, go Bucks, home of Michael Jordan. But they, we reconnected on Facebook just with like, I think talking Walking Dead, or something came up where we were like, hey, you like Walking Dead too? And that's when I was reading the graphic novel, and eventually recruited her down to come be a volunteer at NC Comic Con, has done some panels with us at NC Comic Con as well. And yeah, I finished the graphic novel and I thought it was super rad and badass that Robert Kirkman finished Walking Dead the way he did with a comic. man, that was like pretty gangster. But then I dropped off the TV show a while back. I just told Sylvia I couldn't do it anymore. So I will go back to her when they wrap it up and maybe finish it up. But that's cool. Thanks, Sylvia. Glad you're here with us. Didn't you share at one NC Comic Con where you went to the library and that's how you got into like horror novel or Stephen King, that you would hide the books, library books, behind other books so that people wouldn't
know Stephen King? That and the Exorcist. Wow. Reading that, because a lot of times when I read it, I don't like the film adaptation. Mm-hmm. And yeah, just hiding the books within other, you know, school books all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool. Brian, introduce yourself. Share us who you are and what you do.
I'm Brian Bennett. I'm a campus pastor in Pittsburgh with Lutheran Campus Ministry in Greater Pittsburgh and our student group, student groups Psalm. I serve the students at Pitt, Carnegie Mellon, Chatham, and Carlo Universities. We routinely have a weekly discussion called the Wednesday Word, which is ways that we engage sort of theological reflection in popular culture. So like we did Good Omens last year. So it was a good, the series, not the book, but it worked out well. And before everything really just shut down and moved on. So, but that was good. and I also run every Sunday at the campus ministry, run a Dungeons and Dragons game for folks to join in. And I'm amazed at how popular that became. So, all fun. It's great. So,
yeah, my first D&D campaign was Brian leading a bunch of Lutheran pastors in a campaign. And it was called Holy Crit. And he put out there on his podcast, Church of the Geek, just kind of break down those stereotypes that perhaps pastors shouldn't be doing those things or thinking that way, or sorcery and wizardry and monsters. How could you be doing that? Break down some of those stereotypes and the theology of story of imagination and how that theater of the mind was very fun. And so I really appreciate that. And yep. I'm actually another group of Lutheran pastors wearing this kind of Marvel Heroes, the Marvel D&D version, which has been a lot of fun creating our own characters and running with it. Just been a blast. So,
right. And so I also have the podcast Church of the Geek, which is on almost all the platforms. So
there you go.
Yeah.
Cool.
And my first love, I don't know. I got many loves, but right now the big one is D&D. It's, you know, kind of consuming the life, but it's awesome.
Yeah, that's cool. We're your good DM. So that's great. So tonight let's talk about, I started a God Loves Geeks book club in my church in South Carolina years ago. And how that emerged was people knew that I was a comic book fan and loved sci-fi and Star Wars fan. And whenever a big blockbuster movie would come out, we just noticed that in the narthex, as we were coming in or leaving worship, people would, you know, tug on my robe and say, what did you think about Avengers? What did you think about Fantastic Four? What did you think about this? What did you think about that? And we'd have these little side conversations, eventually like, let's get together and have a small group where we do a reading, where we pick a graphic novel or a book or go see a movie together and then talk about the theological themes that we see within the story, the biblical themes that emerge from it. And so we called it God Loves Geeks and thought I was doing something really innovative and radical and crazy. Then eventually I'm like, wow, other people are doing this too. This is great. And so kind of tonight, that's what we want to do. We didn't have a reading or a book or a graphic novel movie, but just a theme of villains. And I've often heard that it really takes a good villain to make and create a good hero, that a hero isn't necessarily a hero unless it has a good villain to either wrestle with or battle against or shape them and their identity. So tonight I just want to talk about villains. And so how can we talk about our geek of choice? I wanted to go around the horn, and I put this on social media today and kind of my algorithms, but if you had to pick a villain, who was your favorite, or maybe the first villain you remember, or impact, or scared you, or freaked you out? What makes a good villain? If you think of that, what's the first villain that pops in your head for you? And I wanted us to do kind of a mainstream, but is there also not only mainstream villain, that probably most people know about, but is there a deep cut villain that people maybe not first think of, but one that's impacting you or impact the stories that you read and digest? And so we're going to go opposite direction this time in my Zoom. We'll go counterclockwise. Brian, why don't you go first? We'll go the other way.
So I don't know if this is, I don't know. My one of the big villains for me is thinking about it. Sylvia, you mentioned Star Trek, but I think the Borg from The Next Generation are one of my favorite villains, which it was nice to see them back sort of in Star Trek Discovery in the recent Star Trek season. So that was pretty cool. But because they're not the villains in that moment, but there's still some tension there. What are they going to do? How's that going to go? Because they're I think it's clear within Star Trek, there's a whole notion of sort of, there's some sense of communitarianism. There's like, everybody's engaged for the betterment of society. And the Borg are sort of that extreme example. No, we're all in it for the good. You will all be assimilated. Kind of since you have no choice anymore. And so they're a really great, I think they're a great villain out of that. Constant adaptation, constant betterment of the thing. They are a match, if not more so for the Federation. And it is only finally because of Jean-Luc Picard that they come down. So great villain. Will, you okay?
Well, Will figures himself out. Brian, as you were talking about the Borg, you know, I think it's interesting that the Borg, almost without exception, are only villainous when they are the collective. Like, by the time you get through the run of Star Trek, every time you pull a Borg out of the collective, with the exception of the Queen, they become a person that now you're trying to redeem. I mean, obviously, Picard becoming Locutus is the most probably iconic, but you have Hugh, you have Seven of Nine, right? Yeah. And so I don't know, like, just as you were talking about that, it's, you know.
Right, it's the collective that is the villain.
Right.
Yes. They still, you know, the crew can still see them as individuals, even if the collective can't see it. And it is all about the collective making you part of that, right?
Yeah, losing, away your individuality, yeah.
Yeah, losing your will, losing your freedom of all sorts, and becoming part of the hive mind there. So, yeah. No, I just, that was one, I think, watching through it. Like, sometimes you go, okay, we know how they're going to beat that villain. Throughout thinking back the way watching and experiencing that for the first time in Next Generation, like, how are they going to do this? You know, and what does it mean? What's it going to look like? And it's, you know, cause it's not going to be by force. It was not ever going to be by force. Cause the Borg overwhelmed them with that. So, but I think they hit so many things like, about what makes a good villain, you know, and, they were incredibly intimidating and just overwhelming. So,
and also kind of shows kind of this fear of, you might have said that my audio was messing up there for a second, but the kind of this fear of technology too, of taking over us. And you know, there's this intersection of faith and science that goes into transhumanism, kind of the emergence of our human bodies with technology. And there's even a Christian transhumanist society out there that talks about, you know, let's not be scared of technology. Some of us wear glasses, we have pacemakers, there's tech can help us not take away what it means to be human, but help us live fuller into what it means to be human. Whatever people talk about, like the fear of tech or technology, Borg come up, the Terminator comes up, the robots can take over. Oh no, it's already happening with Alexa. And
we're going to get microchips implanted us in our vaccine.
Yeah, yeah. So that villain that hangs out there, they represent this fear of the villain of tech and taking over or overshadowing what it means to be human in the first place. And I think that's, it pushes us to ask those questions, right? And to think through those things. Yeah. Did you have a deep cut villain? Or is that, you want to stick with the Borg?
Well, I'll just say the other one that I was thinking of, it's probably my favorite villain out of Harry Potter, which I don't think folks think about, but I think my favorite villain in Harry Potter is Dolores Umbridge. She's, in some ways, she's like, she's almost a Stephen King like villain. She's frightening because she thinks she's right and she's lawful. She's not chaotic. She's incredibly like, these are the rules. And she manipulates the system to do all the stuff she wants.
She was a more effective villain than Voldemort.
Right. I mean, it's the reason I think Order of the Phoenix is my favorite Harry Potter book, because of her. And if you want to talk about it, there's the whole villain. Like, it's the villain that makes it. Voldemort, by the time you get to the end, he's this big thing and like whatever, but that's great. I love her. I hate her, but I love to hate her.
To hate her, yeah.
I love to hate her.
That makes a good villain. You love to hate him. That's it.
Because she does keep coming back, right, in the sixth and seventh book. There's still a presence there, but
That's good. Sylvia.
Well, my favorite is the first time I was introduced to the character was in a book. And it was funny because this was like the first non-Stephen King book that I actually like carried with me everywhere, to the point where I was going through freshman orientation at UNC Chapel Hill and I had that book on me at all times. Like, it's like, this is the new chapter of your life that's starting. No, I can't put this Thomas Harris book down. So it's Hannibal Lecter from The Silence of the Lambs.
Nice.
And very good.
I enjoy each version of him because, you know, Anthony Hopkins was not the first person on screen to play that character. And to see, you know, Brian Cox's version of it, which is, you know, calm and collective, but, you know, still super intelligent. And then to see Anthony Hopkins just like almost over the top, almost campy version of this genius. And it's like I always end up cheering for Hannibal Lecter for some reason. And then, you know, even though a lot of fans didn't like Hannibal Rising because they said that they were trying to make you feel sympathetic for the character of Hannibal Lecter. And I did. I fell for it. But I liked that origin story. And then, of course, you have Mads Mikkelsen playing Hannibal Lecter on TV. And he just really just adds everything into it. You know, he's impeccably dressed. He's super intelligent. He's always like groomed to, you know, within an inch of his life. But, you know, you're like, he's a sick cannibal. But I can't stop, you know, like wondering what he's going to do next.
I think it was the end of the book Hannibal. Like when you actually get the snapshot of Hannibal and Clarice, like towards the end of their story. And I was like, I don't think I'm supposed to applaud this, but I kind of wanna. And it was just
Yes. Every single time. Every single time.
Well, I was talking with my wife. I was picking her brain. She gets to geek culture a little bit, but obviously not as much as me. And I was like, hey, who's your villain pick? And she had to really think about it. She goes, are you talking about one that like are just so evil that they're irredeemable? And I was like, well, is there anyone that's irredeemable? And she's like, because she started talking about Voldemort and like what his background, you know, could be. And then she talked about Hannibal a little bit about, you know, you get their background. They're just so at a point where you feel sorry for them, or do you love to hate them? Or what is about these villains that you find yourself pulling for them? And it's that heart for the villain that, you know, part of the human condition is pulling for that, not just the underdog, but wanting to see somebody redeemed and turn and become better or repent from their actions. And so yeah, all that's good. That heart for the villain was a big part of their story. And if you're writing a good story and writing a good villain, that's an element that needs to be a part of that recipe, if you ask me. So yeah, I thought you were going to go with Governor or Negan or something like that, but
no, I'm leaving The Walking Dead out of this.
It is okay. I hear you. JR, how about you?
Yeah, I would say one of my favorite, and this is hard because when you talk comics, especially when you talk, you know, mainline comics, you have so many different iterations and incarnations of any character that it's difficult to speak, you know, definitively about any of them. But I think Lex Luthor is one of the two kinds of villains that I like the most. And he represents the villain who is right in his own eyes, and his own, the combination of his own ability and arrogance allows him to justify anything he does.
He's the hero of his own story.
Right, that's it, right? and we never, we honestly, this, so there's a relatively old run of a limited run called Lex Luthor, Man of Steel by Brian Azzarello.
Yes. Yeah.
And that was a huge influence on Empathy for the Devil for me, because I was reading, and Lex Luthor, Man of Steel is a very, like, almost like aggressively generic Superman versus Lex Luthor story, right? It's like you could imagine it being just like a forgettable run lost in the middle of like Action Comics number 600, who cares what, right? Except it's all from Lex's point of view.
Yeah.
And there's a moment in I had the trade and I was reading the trade, and he blows up an orphanage, and like I had been so like swept into the storyline that I was like, well, yeah, man, you got to do what you got to do. And then I had that moment where I was like, whoa, wait, no, that's horrible. Like, this guy's evil. But I had like gotten so caught up in his worldview that his actions made sense to me, you know? Right. And I was like, okay, wow, this is like, this makes Lex Luthor. 'Cause you know, I grew up on the Gene Hackman Lex Luthor from the Superman movies.
Absolutely.
He's just like a bumbling idiot, you know? Somehow he's rich, somehow he's powerful, and you know, the Lex Luthor in this particular incarnation of Lex, I found so much more interesting and compelling, where like he truly believes that Superman is bad for humanity. Right. And the longer Superman is allowed to operate on Earth unchecked, the worse off humanity will be. And obviously he's wrong because it's Superman. But like, I think authors that can write Lex where you really get where he's coming from, it makes it such a more compelling and interesting story, because all of a sudden he's not just mustache twirlingly bad, you know? So like that's kind of the villain that I like. And honestly, I think that's kind of what we're seeing more and more and more of, the Walter Whites. You know,
I was going to bring up Walter White is in that same, and I think Dolores Umbridge also fits in that same way. That's that brand of villain. It's the, sure, Lex is super rich, but
I was talking about that today too, about like the, you want to know, or some of the backstories, you know, you have the villain and you're like, you hate him, they're evil, but then what made him that way? What made him break bad? What made him make the turn? And then you feel sympathetic is there an alternate universe where they didn't break bad, where somebody nurtured them or cared for them more, showed them a different direction that they wouldn't have to be that way. But for Lex, it's the arrogance that Superman's getting all the attention, you know, and that can't happen because he's smarter and better or whatever. So, yeah.
Yeah, the other one, this is my deep cut, though again, I'll throw out a couple of other examples that are not such deep cuts. The other one is the villain that is essentially a personification of some kind of purely evil force. So again, my favorite book series of all time is The Chronicles of Thomas Covenant by Stephen R. Donaldson. It's two trilogies and a tetralogy, so it's 10 books altogether. And the principal nemesis in that series is called Lord Foul. And Foul is, I mean, they throw out two or three different kind of mythologies about where he might have come from. But at the end of the day, Foul is just sort of the personification of evil. And the entire set of books ends up becoming a meditation on how do broken and flawed people engage with the real presence of evil in the world, which is one of the reasons I'm so compelled by these books. I would argue the Joker is this kind of villain, especially in the Dark Knight incarnation and the, you know, the Alan Moore Killing Joke incarnation, the one that most people seem to be resonating with these days. You know, and famously in the Dark Knight, he has three different origin stories and all of them are true and none of them are true, right? DC's even now doing a series they're launching right now called The Three Jokers, where they're suggesting that somehow there are three different incarnations of this Joker. Again, we're going to all find out very soon what they mean by
that. Yeah, if that doesn't get cut, they made some big
That's right.
Hopefully it still happens.
I think some of those are already printed, so I don't think we're going to be missing out on that one.
Honestly, the horror movie that has scared me the most ever when I first watched it, and probably most of the times that I rewatched it, is The Ring. And that's because The Ring, sorry, spoilers for a movie that came out in 99 or 2002 or whenever it came out. You know, it's a very classical ghost story where this girl got murdered as a little kid and her ghost is unhappy. And so the mom goes and frees her and, you know, they're driving off into the sunset and her little weird kid that's maybe psychic or something, which is, you know, like that horror trope. He's like, "Mom, you did what? You let her out? Like, she never sleeps." And you're like, "What?" You know, and then the whole twist at the end of the movie is, no, like, this kid's just evil. And that's why her parents killed her. And now that you've, like, let her out or whatever, like, you've basically just doomed humanity to all be murdered to death by this evil thing. And why is she evil? She just is, you know? And I think that's a different... I think it's a harder story to tell, especially in our contemporary culture where we all kind of want to know the biography and the origin story. But if you can tell it well, it's really compelling because we live in a world where evil is inexplicable and where we still don't know why bad things happen to good people. And so I think having a villain that personifies that in a way that, you know, Batman not only won't kill the Joker, but Batman can't kill the Joker, right? Because the Joker, maybe as the Three Jokers is going to tell us, is an unkillable thing. He's an incarnation of pure chaos, and you can't kill that, right? It's always
they play crazy around with that story idea that they can't survive without the other. If you take one away, Batman. Then how can they be?
Yeah, so I think that's the other, you know, for me, those are the two. There's lots of other kinds of villains, but those are the two that I find the most compelling, personally.
Yeah, thanks, Char. That's great. And when I think about the Joker, too, I think, you know, and Batman, that really kind of thought behind that, the difference between, or fine line between hero and villain, is how one responds to tragedy and loss and pain, right? So for Batman, his response to tragedy and pain and suffering is that he doesn't want anyone else to experience what he experienced. So he's going to do all that he takes, all those gifts, all resources to not let anyone feel that. Joker, on the other side, what he experienced in his life, he wants everyone to feel the same way. If he had to experience it, then everyone else has. So that how do we respond to tragedy, how we respond to pain, makes one hero or villain. I think that speaks to our time today, too. How do we respond to global pandemics or to suffering or pain in our world? How we respond to that really leads us down the path to villainy or to heroism. I think Joker, Batman, glad that came up. Hector, what about you, buddy? What's your...
Well, we share a lot of similar thoughts because all three of my ideas have been spoken, but I'm going to speak to them anyway. I think for me, one of the things that really defines a villain is how uncomfortable would I be in a room with them. Because most bad guys in a story are just people that think they're right when they're wrong. Or maybe by my perspective, they're wrong, or there's someone with an agenda that I can understand, but not necessarily agree with. And so one of the things that I see so a prevalent theme throughout stories of villains is that most villains in pop culture are just anti-heroes waiting to be redeemed. That there aren't really true villains. Growing up watching Dragon Ball Z, it's like, okay, it's only like 99 episodes before the bad guy they're fighting now is their friend. Growing up as watching my three daughters grow up in the My Little Pony era, It's like every bad guy they face eventually becomes their sidekick at some point.
Yeah, because friendship is magic.
Friendship is magic. And some of the songs in the movie, the theatrical movie, were quite banging. But
My Little Pony gets a lot of crap, right?
But it's got some really great stories. It really does. And
good writing.
Weird Al Yankovic plays a character called Cheese Sandwich on there. And
you got Q playing Discord. I mean,
yes. And I love Discord. Discord is actually
great.
Discord's great. Anyway, I don't want to throw all my time on My Little Pony.
That went down a road I did not think was going to happen on that. But man, I'm pleasantly surprised.
Brony's coming out of force.
But so I'll say this for, like, I know we've already visited some of it, but, like, for me, like, the one person I would not want to be in a room with would be the Joker.
Mm-hmm.
I think back to the Alex Ross story of Justice, where Lex Luthor, like, excluded Joker simply because he didn't want someone that dangerous involved, and because he excluded Joker, everything fell apart. I remember watching the Joaquin Phoenix movie last year and thinking, I never want to watch this again. This was wonderfully done, claps for everyone, but I never want to sit through this for the rest of my life. There's been a lot, and I'll say especially in the past 5 years, but if you take it all the way back to Alan Moore's stuff with The Killing Joke, that was twisted. What he did to Barbara Gordon, and even more so what he did to Jim Gordon in that story, made me horribly uncomfortable. Like, even now, like, I've got a 12-year-old girl, you know, my daughter is reading through my entire comic book collection in her own time. And she's like, she always asks, can I read this? And when she pulls out The Killing Joke, I'm like, okay, we have to have a dad-daughter talk before you read this. But it's just one of those things there's so much chaos, so much unpredictability to who he is as a character. Now, granted, if he's poorly written, he's poorly written. You can have a great character, and a great character that's poorly written is not a great character. But some of the stuff that, you know, going from The Killing Joke to even recently some Tom King stuff, there was an episode, there was an issue of Batman, I want to say it was let's go with like a 53 or something like that.
Like right after the Batman's an Atheist, or
that was the Batman's an Atheist one. Hold on, it had to be like a 47 then, something in that nature. It was the Best Man arc.
And
him and Catwoman, yeah,
him and Catwoman Church, and like, I can't believe this book didn't get pulled from shelves. Like, literally, there's a 2-issue arc where Joker murders an entire church full of people at a wedding, individually, and it's horrific. And then he kneels down and asks Batman to pray with him, and I'm just like, literally, as you're turning the page, you don't know what's going to happen. And that's the thing. That tension for me makes a good villain. If I'm uncomfortable because I don't know what's happening next, you're doing your job. If I know that you're going to be redeemed at the end of this story, if I know how this is going to play out, okay, fine, cool. You're just the opposition for this wheel to turn. But I remember reading that arc and it making me uncomfortable. Most recently, Batgirl 47, I think it was like one of the first issues in the Joker War that's just kicked off. It's revisiting Barbara Gordon's story with A Killing Joke. And you've got this story where Barbara Gordon is in her own apartment, and literally all the dialogue through half the book is her self-empowering. You know what? I'm stronger than I am 10 years ago. I've overcome this. I've overcome that. And the entire time, in the corner of your eye, in the background of her apartment, you see that the Joker's just standing there watching her.
Oh, my gosh.
And so you go through like 15 to 20 pages where he doesn't even speak. It's just her living her life and knowing he's standing there. I was like nauseous. Yeah. Just reading that. And it's like, that to me is a good villain. Because if you can be comfortable with the villain of your story, they're not quite the villain. For me. there should never be a point where you're just okay with what they're doing. On the flip side, Dolores Umbridge was my number two, like my deep cut. And you, everything you said with that, I've got nothing to add to it. But I will say that Walter White was my number three. And one of the things that I pointed, like, that when I was like doing some research on Breaking Bad, like when it first ended, not including narcotics, Walter White was responsible for the death of 210 people.
Oh, wow.
Not including a single narcotic. Walter's a mass murderer when you include the airplanes scenario and everything. His blind self-preservation and entitlement literally cost dozens and dozens of lives, not counting the lives that were impacted by the drugs. So, and that's the thing, when you've got a character that truly thinks they are deserving or right, regardless of what it affects other people, that's a scarier, realistic villain.
The point for me when I went, oh, like, I think when that starts, when Breaking Bad starts, you understand there's a lot of forces that are going on in his life, but it's when he lets Jesse's girlfriend choke on her own vomit. I went, that dude is messed up. There is something way more.
Yeah, he was
there and waited.
Yeah.
For it to finish happening.
Let it happen.
I got to say, y'all, I'm one of those people that didn't love Breaking Bad. And it's honestly because in the very first episode, Walter's like, oh, I have cancer. What am I going to do? And his ex-business partner is like, oh, I'll pay for everything. And he goes, no. I was like, oh, okay, I'm done. Like, done with the show. Like, I get it. I get, like, I get that that's his, but he's like, that's who he is. And I understand. Don't at me. I mean, you can at me if you want, but I understand that's the point of the show, right? Yeah, I understand that that's literally like what he was, Heisenberg then. And it's not him becoming Heisenberg. It's Heisenberg being revealed. I understand what the show did. I'm just saying, like, that moment that we see him in Jesse's apartment with Jessica Jones, like, it was the same guy that said no to treatment because he was arrogant, you know? So
Heisenberg was like, just becoming more prevalent.
Right.
He was
right.
always and, there.
Yeah. Yeah. And so for me, it was, it just, I guess I got it in the first episode. So I didn't want to watch, I did, but I didn't want to watch five seasons of it.
Which for me, that's one of the things that I love / hate about Better Call Saul. Which to me is honestly as good or a better than Show.
Like it's way better. Way better.
Because with Walter White, he was always Heisenberg. He just didn't have the tenacity to be who he was. Where I think on the flip side, Jimmy was not always Saul. Right. I think that
he's being made to be Saul.
He's being made to be Saul. Whereas like Walter was always the villain, but Saul became the bad guy due to circumstances. And
totally agree.
Yeah, with Break Ray, I remember when he was watching Jesse's girlfriend die. My wife turned to me and said, "I don't want to watch this show anymore." She's like, "I can't do this anymore." And I was like, "I know," but I'm like, "Please, I got to figure out what's going on." And so we did keep watching, but it is like that break it. And that show messed me up in a way that, like, not only rolling up to a gas station, and pumping gas in my car and looking at the person in front of me who's driving a nice car, I'm like, I bet that guy deals meth. You know, like everybody was
everyone deals meth.
I think that, I don't know. Oh, that guy could be dealing meth or representing someone in the court or hiding meth in their house. I don't know. But it also made me pay attention to the small decisions I make during the day that make a big difference. So that one decision that Walter White made about, like, no, I'm refusing because my pride won't let me take any help from you because of what happened a while back, set him down this road that cost thousands of lives and messed people up, and these drug cartels, not only in our country but other countries. It's just how things unravel. I was like, man, I wonder if there's decisions that I make or little things that I do that my pride or sin gets in the way that affect people larger down the way. I think we're finding with this pandemic that we're all interconnected down to the quantum level, that we're all related and affect one another in the decisions that we make. So yeah, that's good. My deep cut was Saul, Better Call Saul. Like, yeah, he is
who in that show.
I mean, I love that show so much. And it is like, I feel like my kids can watch that. Eventually they can get around and watch Breaking Bad. But yeah, it's like, hey, you can watch this now. And there's some intense scenes and some violence. But in terms of the comedy, but also decisions you make along the way, whether it's pride or yeah. It's
the desert scene from the last season.
Yeah.
Like him and Mike in the desert literally is one of my standalone favorite pieces of television.
Yeah. And then the music, like I sound hounded that song. I was like, oh, that's what Eminem sampled. I didn't realize that's what, got it. So I did do, so my main top villain, as I have to say, I have to raise up, is being a Star Wars fan, is Vader. Cause as a 5 or 6 year old with the first movie I ever saw in the theater, Star Wars, A New Hope, when that villain walks in with the black cape and he's looking over all these dead rebels and choking people out with the Force, like, who is this? He's freaking me out with that deep breathing, and eventually you get the backstory. And eventually with Star Wars, you find out the real, I mean, you get Vader's backstory of why he became a villain and his redemption, that it really is a Vader story. But then the real villain is Palpatine. And do you ever really feel like Darth Sidious, do you really feel like he's redeemable? Do you want him to turn to the light? I never once in a Star Wars story go, man, I wish he'd become good. I see good in him. Why can't you never, at least I don't feel like Palpatine is redeemable. And we find that all the way through by the Skywalker. But for me,
that's one reason I didn't bring up Sauron either. Cause that would have been another one, right? Sauron or the Ring in Lord of the Rings. Like that's, I don't know what to do with a villain that is irredeemable.
Right.
Well, so again, I think they're that, like, they're not meant to be redeemable, right? They're like almost like a personification of I don't want to say omnipresence, but like the ever presence of evil.
Right.
Right. You can win a war. You can maybe eradicate a disease, but there's always going to be something, right? There's always going to be something in the world.
The only solution for for Sauron in the Ring was destroy it.
Mm-hmm.
There is no other option.
It's just, there are some evils that can't be resolved relationally that can only be end in destruction.
That'll preach. Write that down right there. That's in your book somewhere. So I did a little Google online today to look at like the, you know, top 100 villains of all time. And I love that number 49 and one of them was Hans Gruber from Die Hard. I thought, I was like, that's a pretty good villain. But then the most top
he's an exceptional, an exceptional thief.
That's right. the most top 100 list had around these five. Well, Nerdist had like a March Madness top villains you vote, kind of like Church of Geek did this on Twitter, your favorite heroes, favorite ships. But the final was between Vader and Joker, and Vader ended up winning a little bit. That's just a strange Twitter thing. No. The final four was Vader, Joker, Voldemort, and Sauron. In their
mind. Who's putting Voldemort in a top villain? Come on.
Dude couldn't even take over a high school.
Yeah.
But I love that another top 100 list had number 5 Magneto. I mean, an X-Men fan, my first love in geek world was X-Men comics and Star Wars movies. But so X-Men Magneto, 4 was Vader, 3 was Joker, 2 was Freddy Krueger. Mm. So in terms of the horror, they bring up Freddy Krueger. And then number 1, I thought they just put Nazis as the number 1 villain. And they were like, if you're going to talk about like villains in pop culture, whether it's Schindler's List to Indiana Jones to Hellboy,
Captain America,
that they are the group that is the villains. And again, this relation, you destroy it, or is it redeemable through relationships, kind of thing. So I thought that was interesting in terms of these lists of villain. I guess the other question to you, we are getting towards the end, but kind of thinking theologically, philosophically, are villains necessary for a good story, you know, in terms of our story, our salvation story, or the divine story that we're a part of? Are villains necessary? Is problem of pain a part of that? Where does that come into play? Are villains necessary for a good story or hero's story?
I think that villains, I don't think the villains are necessary. I think conflict is necessary. So if the conflict can actually take internally or actually be within a person and what they're going through, then great. I think that villains are at their best when they mirror
what we are going through or the what the hero of the story is going through. That, you know, they can be a cheap plot device if you're not actually interested in writing something real, or they can be the best personification of what you're trying to do.
Yeah. So it focuses on that conflict. So not necessarily villainy or evil, those things, but in terms of conflict, what shapes us into our identity? You know, loss and love are part of the human story. Love and loss, or loss of love, and grieving the loss of love, or death, you know, that conflict that we wrestle with. And what do we do with that pain? What do we do with that conflict?
I would argue that one of, if not the most honest and powerful depictions of movement toward redemption in recent cinema was Manchester by the Sea, featuring known dirtbag Casey Affleck, still a good movie. And that has no villain in it. There's no death is a villain, right? So yeah, I mean, if I'm going to go theological and say, and the last enemy is death, sure, I'm fine with that. But there's no villain in that story. It's the main character's inability to receive a love that leads to forgiveness, that keeps him from being redeemed. And I mean, I don't want to spoil the ending. I'll just say I argued on Real World Theology when I was on the episode for Manchester for that podcast. I argued that what we see at the end of the film is the possibility of redemption, where at the beginning of the film, there's no possibility of hope. And so we don't even see redemption. We just see, like, literally the door is now cracked open and a small thin ray of light is piercing the darkness. And we're wondering, you know, and so again, I think it's beautiful. I think it's powerful. I think it's actually way more redemptive than Star Wars. Feel free to at me. I'll fight you about that all day. I don't think Vader has a redemption arc. I think he has a forgiveness arc. And there's no villain in it. So,
yeah.
So what are you going to say?
Yeah.
I think that the villain is necessary because the average person that's watching cinema is not thinking beyond what's right in front of them. And sometimes you need them because it's like, okay, we're putting these bad people here for you to get a light version of what some of the rest of us are getting. And I used, like, I didn't get to say what my deep cut was, and I had two. One was Colonel Jessup from A Few Good Men, The other was the representation of liberal / systemic racism by the Armitage family in the movie Get Out.
Yeah, that's great.
That whole three generations of an entire family just wreaking havoc unknowingly. It's terrifying. It really is. And for me, being, you know, one half of interracial marriage and doing that whole meet the parents, guess who's coming to dinner thing, and they live out in the middle, in my case, in the middle of Michigan. The movie comes along and it's like, oh my gosh, like, what if there was an auction going on and someone
wow.
So yeah, I think the villain is necessary for people that aren't looking beyond just the words and the people on the screen.
Yeah, I think you and JR are horror fan. I like horror. I didn't grow up a big horror fan, but I think what it does is that apocalyptic genre that holds up a mirror that helps you go deeper into yourself. And you're either, am I doing that, or am I a part of that story? Are we, am I contributing to that? Yeah, get Peel knew what he was doing in terms of Get Out. It's like, are we going to see a horror movie, or is this a commentary on society and kind of the systemic problems that are within it, not just beyond my household, but also within me? And so I think villain conflict, horror, things like that help us go deeper into some interpersonal reflection on who I am and my own identity and what I contribute to the world. So yeah, I'm glad you shared that. That's good. And that ties in, you know, horror, but also villainy. It's not just a person, but it could be a system that you're under. So that's strong.
And I think, Sylvia, to your point, having a face to that system does make it way more tangible for folks. I mean, I know a lot of the folks that I pastor have a really hard time understanding systemic evil. And they want to just say, like, who do I vote for or not vote for? And it's like, well, sometimes it's not that easy.
But tell me who the bad guy is so I can hate
him. Right. In a film, it can be, right? We can have a Red Skull who is the Nazis, right? Mm-hmm. And why is he bad? Well, because he's a Nazi. Nazis are bad. And that's, you know, we spend our time on superhero fights, not on ideology, so.
Another set of impeccably dressed villains.
Yeah.
Thanks to Bill Boss.
Yeah, there's some well-dressed villains out there. Yeah, true. Well, we're getting to the end here, getting close to an hour. I don't want to leave anything hanging. If there's anything hanging out there in terms you want to contribute to share about villains and how that affects story or faith, culture, what you see into your context, is there anything we're leaving hanging out there?
I would say the thing that has helped me the most with both appreciating villains and reading stories theologically is we always all assume we're the heroes of our own stories. Yeah. I think that's the easy assumption for us to make. And so if you can extend some empathy and assume that a well-written villain probably thinks they're the hero of their own story, right? So they might have coherent reasons for doing what they're doing, not necessarily good, but coherent reasons that make sense, right? If you can put yourself in their shoes, and then being able to do that, being able to assume maybe I'm the Pharisees, not the disciples, actually can be a very valuable spiritual practice where I basically quit giving myself the benefit of the doubt. And I start treating myself with a hermeneutic of suspicion. I think when I do that, I then open up some space for the Holy Spirit to show me, to your point, Will, right, the seeds of the Heisenberg that might be growing in my own heart, because seeds are a lot easier to pluck out than fully grown plants that have taken root. So
suddenly we find ourselves in the Michelin Web skit. Are we the baddies?
Yeah. What can it be?
Are we the baddies?
Yeah. I mean, when I stand up in church on Sunday and Jesus talks about, you know, the hypocrite standing in long robes. I mean, as a Lutheran, I wear long robes every Sunday. And I'm like, man, this is hard to read, y'all.
Come on, Jesus.
Come on, Jesus. Why are you so hard on me?
I don't have any fringes on the bottom of my stole.
Right.
That's why I have cargo shorts.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's things where to think through, and so part of what these Theocon conversations is to model for those who are watching ways that they can engage pop culture and geek culture and their own lives and their own faith, their own discipleship, and how they grow in that. So I hope we modeled that tonight, taking a theme and lifting up some popular stories or villains to think through how that can affect the stories and media that we digest, but also in terms of how our faith lives out and plays out in the world. And I do encourage all of you who are watching to listen to the Faith and Fandom, read his books, to go to Think Christian, to search. And JR, tell me the name of that book again, though, that I'm going to order on Amazon tomorrow.
Empathy for the Devil.
Okay, Empathy for the Devil. And so there are avenues. Maybe you perhaps would want to start a God Loves Geeks book club in your church or in your youth group or campus ministry. Feel free to message me. I'd be happy to make some recommendations on what you can read and how you can start that in your own place. And so we're happy to be a part of Theocon. We will continue to do these Thursday conversations, Theocon Thursdays, leading up to September, and go to theocon.live and on the Facebook page to find out what we're going to do in September and how you can engage and be a part of how you can be a part of the event or conference or conversation that we were going to have. We were going to have another kind of thing in terms of what we were going to geek out, but I think we're running out of time, Brian, so I think we're going to kind of wrap that out. Maybe we can go around the corner. I think we have extra 5 minutes. This is going to be on YouTube. If they want to fast forward or end it, they can watch it later. Let's go around the horn. And what's one thing you're geeking out on now? We talked about something that you're really hyped about that you're diving into. And so, Sylvia, why don't you go first this time?
You got me back on the Octavia Butler training.
Ooh, yeah.
He writes some wild stuff. super scary. And I know that the new Antebellum movie that may or may not be released in the theaters, it's based on one of her books.
Is? Kindred. Okay, so I saw the trailer and I was like, oh, it's Kindred the movie. And then it was called Antebellum. And I was like, but it is based on Kindred?
We're going to say that it is.
Okay. I mean, it sure looks like it is. All right. Yeah. It's so nice to have a writer who's writing and releasing books right now that are kind of those came out in the 80s? Is that right? Right. Oh, okay.
90s. The 90s. Okay. I read Parable of the Sower, and at the end of the book, I don't suffer from panic attacks. I'm a surfer. I'm too laid back for that. But I guess at the end of Parable of the Sower, I had a panic attack because I'm like, we're there. We're in the 2020s. This is happening. And I had to go like calm down somewhere and go pet my dog or something. But yeah, I'm with you, Sue. That's what I'm geeking out on. Parable of the Sower and Parable of Talents changed how I view the world in terms of African-American sci-fi womanist author. In these times it came to me at the appropriate time and appropriate time in history. So good call. Hector, what are you geeking out on?
Two things. Studio Ghibli movies. Just got HBO Max, and so me and my kids are watching through all of those. I think we've made it through 16 of them so far. And loving that, loving the whole, every story doesn't have to end with a couple hooking up, and that it can just be pure good storytelling. And the other thing is Downton Abbey. I watched it all before, but like my kids are watching it now with me. And we actually took an impromptu road trip to the Biltmore Estates because they have a Downton Abbey exhibit with all the sets from the show and everything. And so we walked around and talked about British baking and stuff. So it was great.
Yeah. We went over there this summer over there. And Ella, my youngest 16-year-old, loved Downton Abbey. And when she went into that one, looking at the costume, she literally teared up. And I was like, there you go. Everybody geeks out on something. That's good. JR, what are you geeking out on these days?
So I just finished a book that has just announced today as we're recording, has been optioned as a limited series at Hulu. It's by Silvia Marino Garcia, and it's called Mexican Gothic, which is literally the perfect name for this book because it is a Mexican twist on the Victorian Gothic horror novel. Wow. So if you know all the tropes of Victorian Gothic, if you've read The Haunting of Hill House or any of that, and you read this, it'll completely explode your brain. A, just what a great book it is. B, how scary it is. And C, like all of the things that like are twists on the classic Victorian tropes. If you don't know any of that stuff, you still got A and B to enjoy. It's tremendous. I've made like everyone I know read it, and they've all thanked me / cursed me when they couldn't sleep.
By this
so, note. It is, man, I could go on at length about this book, but I won't. It's just amazing. Mexican Gothic.
Cool.
Should we buy your book or that book?
Buy her book, please. Okay. I mean, yeah, I'd love to sell my book, but come on.
I have a continuing ed fund at church. I'll put it on that God Loves Geeks tab and get back. There you go.
You won't be sorry, I think, unless it just keeps you up for the next four nights, but cool. You're welcome.
Brian.
I got three episodes left of the second season of Umbrella Academy, which has been so fun. The first season was good and I liked it, and I'd never read the comic, but it was a little slow getting everything in order in that first season. It gets everything in place and it ends great, but the second season starts at that same pitch and has not let up for seven episodes, and I got three left, and wow, it's great.
By the way, don't read the comic.
Right. I liked the comic.
So my co-host was disappointed because he liked the comic and didn't like the series wasn't weird enough for him, I think would be the fair way to say. And so I don't think he was real thrilled with it. He liked them. So I was thinking about picking it up, but I've also heard other people that I really respect go, I like the series way better than the comic. So you probably in that.
Sylvia, did you read those or see that, read the comics or watch Umbrella? Sylvia, did you? No. Because I know Jarway came to NC. Yeah.
So the thing I'll just say to this, the comic is beautifully done, exquisitely weird, but it's like someone drank an entire bottle of codeine cough syrup, watched the series, and then sketched what they were doing with their eyes closed.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
I mean, I like the comic.
The first volume, the first volume is great. I love the first volume, the first trade. I thought was really well done, a different take on a superhero or X-Men comic. The second volume, I it was hard for me because he was channeling Grant Morrison too much to be like, this is, I'm smarter than you or more meta than you, and I couldn't follow what's going on. Or maybe I was just distracted.
The third's not better with that.
Yeah, exactly. So the first volume is good, and in fact, I'm getting texts now from my family going, we have two episodes of Umbrella Academy to finish tonight. When are you going to be home? So we have two episodes left, and they're ready. And we went camping last week. I handed the first trade to my youngest, and she's like, "Yeah, this is good. This is good." But I like the TV better. She just followed it better. But yeah, good stuff. I recommend that show too. And talk about stories and villains. Are we the hero of our own story? And how we affect and shape one another by our actions is a big part of that too. Cool, y'all. Thanks so much for doing this, and we're glad, and we hope that you can be a part of TheoCon in the future, whether it's virtual or whether it's online or whenever we meet again, whether it's 2021 or 2023. I don't know when we can all get back together again, but we'll eventually be able to do cons and conferences together, and we hope that you can come and be a part of TheoCon in the future.